Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from Delta EE, the new energy experts. We'll be talking about how the energy transition is developing across Europe, with guests who are working at the leading edge of this transition. We're in the midst of a transition from old to new energy. The transition's messy. It's disrupting utilities, creating opportunities for new entrants, bringing in big established companies from other sectors, and enabling product manufacturers and tech companies to extend their position up and down the value chain. I'll be exploring these issues with Ian Marchant this week. Ian served as Chief Executive Officer with utility company SSE for 11 years and has been highly active in the energy sector ever since stepping down from that position. Hello, Ian.
Good morning, John.
So, Ian, you've got a very interesting perspective, having served as CEO and then a variety of other positions since then. Tell us a bit about how you see the energy transition unfolding at the moment.
I've always thought that this decade will mark the tipping point between the old energy economy and the new energy economy. And if you think, the old energy economy was defined by carbon intensive, big iron, analog solutions. Whereas the new energy economy is rapidly becoming a silicon based, distributed digital energy environment. And it's interesting, if you like, my own career in this decade has transitioned from that old world. The big company, you can't get much bigger in the utility context of SSE involved in every bit of the energy value chain, to a much more plural and decentralized career that I have now.
And how long ago since you left SSE?
It's frightening to think, it's nearly 6 years.
Wow. And you've not exactly been putting your feet up and sailing off into the sunset, have you?
No, I do a variety of different things. I chair a couple of boards. I chair Wood Group up in Aberdeen, which is the energy services company. I chair Thames Water, so I ventured into a new sector. I'm on the board of Aggreko, the temporary power generator. There's the big companies that I get involved in. But then I've invested in many, many startup businesses, most in the energy and clean tech space, through my company Dunelm Energy. So again, my career is currently straddling big and small.
So you've got FTSE 100 board positions, and you've got advisor and investor to entrepreneurs.
Yeah. I think the smallest company I've been involved in is probably about 3 people.
Right.
And the largest is about 70,000. So it's a fairly big spread.
And you're having fun?
Yes. It is a fun, I like the variety, I like the change, I like the fact that every day is different, and I'll probably be dealing with, on any given day, between 5 and 15 different companies and organisations. And I throw in the odd curveball into the mix. I'm also honorary president of the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, Edinburgh Zoo to most people. So that's a bit of a curveball.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like a busy but fun and stimulating way. To spend your time.
Indeed, yeah.
And coming back to the energy transition then, when you stepped down from SSE, what were the big issues at that time on your plate, or what big issues did you hand over to your successor?
Well, I think in this transition point, that one of the things that's really struck me as I was in SSE and as I've left is that the big utilities really struggled with disruptive innovation, because the big utilities have at their heart and their DNA that public service ethos of always keeping the lights on 24/7 and a strong safety culture. And that's not conducive to trying things that won't work, to pushing the envelope, to being a bit innovative and creative.
Do you think you could say that's the case for any incumbents in any sector, or even more so for energy because of that safety and public service?
I think it's probably acute in the energy sector. It's not unique, but acute, because you're always on. Mm. You can't take your factory offline for a day. You can't switch the lights off for a day and try something different. So your ability to trial and test things is harder, but it's the same for any 24/7 industry. And culturally, I think therefore that sort of need for robustness and resilience is a real struggle. That was something I struggled with as a chief executive, how to get the organization to test and learn stuff. The whole idea of launching minimum viable products, which is the big one of the big things in the digital world, is just a complete anathema to a utility. It's got to work, and it's got to work in all circumstances.
And is that changing now from the outside, the relationships you still have? Because they are, to be fair to utilities, they are trying, I think, in many ways.
Yes, I mean, and I look at what we did and what is being done, and you're trying to do that, but there is inherent tension between that need for resilience and robustness and the need for innovation and creativity. Some and utilities are trying different things to do that. I think you described the transition as bumpy, and that's the reality that these companies will struggle with that. The other thing that incumbents, and I see this in all sectors, is all large companies, large organizations, are effectively bureaucracies. They have to be. They have to have procedures. They have to have delegated authorities. And therefore, getting the organization, any organization, to move at speed is a real challenge. And a typical startup company's speed turnover is a fraction of what it is for a large company. And that tension on timing is a real, we're interested in your product and we'd like to order a few. It'll take us 6 months to get you through the procurement system, by which time the startup will have run out of cash. Those are the tensions, and utilities try different ways of dealing with it, but bureaucracies struggle with disruptive change, and it's no different than other sectors.
So is it, would it be too strong to say you're pessimistic about utilities' ability to transform themselves, or is that too strong?
That's probably a little too strong. I mean, if you take the UK as an example, we have effectively seven big incumbents, the six energy suppliers and National Grid. They will not all succeed. You can probably ask me which ones will. That, of course, is the challenge. I don't know. But the reality is, in most periods of disruptive change in most industries, not all incumbents survive. Some will. Some will manage the change. Some will struggle and will cease to be relevant and will sort of disappear.
So from the other side of the fence, the startups you're involved in, the emerging growing companies, are they going to carve out some of that for themselves, or what's your perspective on life as a startup on your interest?
Firstly, I've invested in over 70 companies, not all in the energy and clean tech space, and I've probably to date had seven or eight that have failed. I've had a couple of successful exits and a couple of less successful exits, but not failures. So the reality is, in the startup world, you will get more failures than successes. That's why you invest, that's why you develop a portfolio, because not everyone will succeed. However, some absolutely will, and they will succeed in broadly, there are one of two paths. They will grab a slice of the market for themselves and grow and become a relevant and key part of the environment. And if you think about retailing, as an example, Amazon was a startup once. So that's one route that these companies will go through.
And that the other route is about growing a brand, growing a customer brand, or
growing either a brand or a piece of technology or a place in the value chain that means you can survive as an independent entity. The other is obviously exiting to a player it could be one of the incumbent utilities, or it could be somebody who's looking to stretch their market, their services into the utility space. So the two exits that I've had have both been to, one was actually to another venture capitalist who wants to roll the money and thinks they can make a return on a large, and the other one's to a trade player. So when you're looking at these startup companies, you're looking at both potential. Can they stand on their own 2 feet and generate recurring revenue, or are they creating an attractive proposition that other players will want? And you actually want to see both are possible.
What surprised you with these 70 companies, you know, from a big incumbent utility to having exposure to these 70 companies? What have you learned, or what have you been surprised by?
Well, I think the biggest surprise that I've had is how many startups there are. Mm. Because as I said, I've invested in over 70, of which probably about 50 are in the energy clean tech space. And I have passed on more than that. So there's a lot of things going on. And what has surprised me most, I say, is the amount of entrepreneurialism and innovation that is happening out there. And all bar about three of my companies are UK. So it's very much a UK statement. And I've been surprised. And I was at one of the universities I'm connected with doing a talk to their energy society last month. And you always get questions about careers and noticeable difference than even 10 years ago. The questions were more about joining a startup, starting their own business, than joining the large incumbents.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, even at the undergraduate level, there is that interest in this whole sort of growth economy.
Yeah. I mean, we've been staggered at Delta by the number of startups across Europe.
Yes.
When we just look at aggregators pouncing on often really small price signals and really small value pools.
Yes.
More than 70 aggregators across Europe.
Yes.
So no shortage of ideas and energy and passion.
Yeah.
But sometimes the shortage of money, revenues.
When I'm looking at a startup company, you're looking at effectively four things you want to see the company's route to. There's a route to technology. Now, quite often these companies are software companies. Mm. And obviously a big theme at the moment is artificial intelligence, machine learning, data algorithms. So where is their route to that technology that they want to use to exploit that value opportunities? That's the first one, route to technology. The second is route to resources, people. They're connected, those two, obviously. Well, you say you want to go and recruit data scientists, but actually, so do everybody else. So can you actually get them?
Hmm.
The third is, people talk about routes to market. I'm actually thinking it's routes to sales. And this is where the relationship with the large companies comes in. Mm. You know, what is the small startup's route to sales? And are they being realistic about how long it will take to convert a nice bit of interest at a conference to an actual purchase order? And then the last one is route to capital, money. But obviously that's what I'm interested in providing some of. So someone's going to get through the first three hurdles before I start on that one.
So route to tech, route to people, route to sales, and route to capital.
Yes.
My perspective, Ian, will probably be that the route to sales is often to avoid being piloted to death.
Yes.
That route to sales is possibly the most challenging.
I would say that most businesses fail on that one. Mm. But they might be failing on that one because they haven't got the right people,
right,
or they haven't got the right tech.
Yeah.
But the reason why companies don't succeed generally is they don't convert interest and pilots to enduring sales orders quick enough, and they run out of capital.
Yeah.
And the providers of capital, people like me and other angel investors, just lose patience with, I've heard for 5 months in a row that this order's about to arrive.
Yeah.
And now you've run out of money, I'm I'm sorry. Yeah, so yeah, yes, so I think for most startup companies, the key bit in the second phase, in the first phase, it is around establishing the technology and defining where you are in the market. Yeah. The second phase is about sales. And frequently, I'm finding myself giving myself more and more advice to the founder CEOs. They say, I need to go and get a head of sales or head of marketing. Say, you're the best head of sales or marketing for this organization. Maybe you should go and recruit someone who can take some of the other stuff off your agenda so you can get out, because you can develop the first few orders. And once you've got the first few orders, then the next ones follow.
Let's go back now to your utility experience and that, as you described, rather conservative, risk-averse,
yeah,
public service-type organisation. You try to instill not a new culture, but some new thinking within SSE. Yes. Tell us a bit about the challenges that you had at that time in doing that, or the successes you had in doing that.
Well, the first thing that, and I think all organisations, small and large, have to recognise is innovation is actually a product of three different stages. You have invention, improvement, and implementation. And you actually need to take any idea through those. Now, an inventor is the person who comes up with the idea, who spots the opportunity. An improver is the one who takes that spark and molds it and adds things to it. And then the implementer is the person that actually delivers it and gets it done and gets it sold or whatever. I'm by nature an improver.
Right.
The trick in the large utilities was identifying the inventors. Where are the entrepreneurs in a large company? Because they tend to select out. And how do you link those three phases together? Because within a large company, the real skill usually lay in the implementers, because it was the people who were implementers who could get the machinery of the organization to work.
So there's no shortage of ideas, is there? There's, in some ways, the innovation departments or the VC departments of utilities,
yes,
are a bit like kids in a sweetie shop. There's so many things you could choose from.
One of the things that I did in SSE was I created a license to innovate. So people would pitch their idea initially to me, and if I thought it was worth pursuing, I would give them a license. I'm literally a piece of paper with a signature on thing. You have to spend 5 to 10% of their time pursuing that idea, because everybody has a day job. And in a keep the lights on culture, that day job is critical. And it was about convincing their manager to allow this person to have some time to frolic off on their own, as far as the manager could see. So it was about me running a bit of interference for people with the spark of an idea and pushing. Now, many of those were not sort of market-facing ideas. They were business improvement ideas.
Yeah.
But being able to celebrate and protect innovation, it was also about making people aware of what was actually going on outside. Now, you have to remember, I'm talking about events now maybe of 10 years ago, where the whole app development movement was in its infancy. How to convince a company like SSE that apps had a place in their, well, actually the real way was find a good use case, develop one, put it out there, and see it happening. The other thing we did at SSE was investing into some middle stage companies, not the early stuff that I'm doing, but the sort of growth company stage through the ventures unit, which was pretty successful. Some failures, some successes.
And I guess if you look at a company like Centrica, they've spent quite a lot of money acquiring those sort of mid stage companies.
Yes, yeah, that would be the third, if you like, the third stage. What SSE did was that venture investing, where you might go and buy 20% of a company.
Yeah.
What Centrica have then gone and done is bought the whole thing.
Yeah.
Hive being the classic example. It used to be a company called Alert.
Yeah.
Centrica effectively said, having watched and learned about that company, and said, we would like to buy the whole thing in.
And how much does leadership matter? Because what you did at what you've described at SSC sends quite a strong signal in some ways that this is important to you as the CEO.
In almost every aspect of large organisations, the leadership has a disproportionate impact. Mm. You're not just one person. And if the organisation knows that you're interested in innovation and creativity and new ideas, you'll get to hear them. Mm. If you are known to be the sort of person who likes to say no to everything, people will stop coming. Yeah. So it's the same. If you are going out on a visit to a remote location and your first questions are about the money and not about the safety of the people,
yeah,
that sends a signal as to what's important to you. So your behaviours and the questions that you ask and how you lead conversations and what you spend your time doing sends signals throughout the organisation. Innovation being no different than anything else. Mm.
And for you then, that was just a balance between your focus on that and your focus on the, I might say the day-to-day, but the more immediate issues.
I was fortunate that I had a chief operating officer, a guy called Colin Hood, who for 9 of the 11 years worked for me. Mm. His main focus was keeping the lights on.
Yeah.
And my main focus was external, ambassadorial stuff, shareholders, regulators, politicians, and change, innovation,
yeah,
future. Now, I say main because we both had to cover the other side. But it is very difficult in these large organisations for any one person to keep in that, the tension in their head between the today,
yeah,
and the day after tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Let's finish by looking forward now at the next years. We've talked a bit before about the disruption that electric vehicles will bring, for example. Yes. If you fast forward, well, maybe you said that this decade, the decade we're currently coming to the end of, was a tipping point. How would you characterise the next decade?
I think the next decade, generically, in some fields, is going to be the decade of mass deployment. So I'll give you two examples where I think that is true, and then one where I still think we're in tipping point mode. I think that in vehicle transport, it's mass deployment. I think in 2030, if we take that, I don't think there'll be any cars that are sold that haven't got battery in them. They may be hybrid still, but it will be the norm. And it will, if you want a pure petrol engine car, you'll have to buy a classic car.
You'll be a bit odd.
Well, no, you might still want to do it, but it will not be that when you go into the showroom.
Yeah.
You'll be buying classic cars or what we'll see. So I think there we'll see mass deployment. We're already seeing electricity, mass deployment of technologies down into the home. I think you'll see many more batteries and homes becoming prosumer and smart for around electricity. So I think that's another area where we'll see sort of the accelerated deployment curve. The one that I still struggle to know what the solution is heat.
Yeah.
And it's not rural heat, because in the rural world, I think a combination of heat pumps and biomass can solve rural heat. The challenge is going to be urban heat.
Yeah.
We're sitting in a relatively small city of like Edinburgh, population around 600,000. Actually, how do you heat Edinburgh in a low carbon or zero carbon way? Very, very difficult, because you cannot import enough biomass, because we did that in the 1800s and we end up with smog and all those sorts of things. And there isn't enough land to do all the drilling for the heat pumps. So you have to find a way of decarbonising urban heat. And I mentioned Edinburgh. I mean, you think Glasgow's an order of magnitude bigger than London is, you know, 7-8 million. So I think the next decade in urban heat is around testing business models, testing technologies. It's not about, except that's the decade after.
So implementation for electric vehicles, implementation for prosumers, demand side response, yeah. assets on the customer side of the yeah. meter, heat still a bit open.
Yes.
And in terms of winners and losers, not asking you to name them, yeah. but to give an example, Volkswagen has launched a subsidiary called Elli that will be as much a mobility and energy company as it will a manufacturer of electric vehicles. There's questions as to if some cynics say this is just positioning, this is greenwashing. My own view is that the 5 to 10 years' time, as you said, some of the incumbent utilities yeah. might not exist, might have been bought, might have faded away. Will we see Amazon, Volkswagen, companies from other sectors being as much energy companies as incumbent utilities?
I think we will see this this boundary of what an energy company will change. And in 10, 15 years' time, we won't be thinking about it the same way. You know, is Amazon a retailer or a data analytics company or a software services
company? Or a logistics company.
Or a logistics company. Companies will have their history and their DNA, but that there will be more companies playing around with the provision of services to the home. And some of those will lead with energy, some will lead with insurance.
Or mobility.
Some,
or...
you know, in 20 years' time, we probably won't own our own cars. We will be using mobility as a service. And we'll wake up in the morning and order our driverless car to come to our front door in half an hour's time. And it's parked on the edge of town. It's probably all electric, and we specify what sort of car we want. Now, who's doing that? Is it the vehicle manufacturer? Is it Volkswagen? Is it
Uber, a technology company?
A technology company? Is it an energy company that's worrying about the provision of power to those vehicles? Is it a car hire company like Enterprise? Is it the local transport company, Lothian Buses, here in Edinburgh? Or is it a company that you and I have never heard of,
doesn't exist
today,
yeah.
or is three people in a garage somewhere dreaming it up? And the answer is probably all of the
above,
in different places. So it's one of these things, I can predict there will be winners and losers, I just can't say who.
So it will carry on being messy, it will carry on being bumpy.
Yeah.
There will be winners, there will be losers.
Yes.
If you had to pick out one thing that will characterize the winners, both from, I guess, your experience with startups, with FTSE 100 companies, what would your advice be in sort of keep front of mind?
It's the quote, I can't remember who said it, but it goes along the lines, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And I think it's the companies who get ahead, think creatively, meet the customer's needs, and create the future that will be the winners.
Okay, so not sitting waiting for the answer, but helping to craft out what the answer is. Well, let's hope some of your startups that you've invested in are amongst them,
yes? Yes, indeed. It'd be nice to think I've got at least one Amazon in the list.
Well, thanks for your time. It's been fascinating as always talking, and we'll maybe talk again in a while and see how things are unfolding and what surprised us and what has rolled out in the way we thought it would.
Okay, thanks very much, John.
Thanks, Ian. And thank you for listening, and I look forward to the next episode.